all the way through the time he was governor.
Okay.
So I got to see him.
House Committee on Revenue for February 4th, 2009 will come to order. We have three public hearings scheduled for today, and we have an hour and a half because the House is meeting today. I want to be out of committee by 9:30. The House meets at 9:45. So we're going to start our public hearings and go from there, and I think we'll just take them in order. Okay? All right, very good. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2105. Mazin, you're on that one?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
This is the time when you need to borrow the money after all the partying you've done.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my portfolio comes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2105 comes to you from MDA, from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. I did not write much about this in your SMS because I think we need to learn a lot more. To me, it seems that it's just permissive for the different governments or the different entities and the state treasurer to be able to invest and use monies into the different types of instruments, debt for the most part. And on line 19, first page, subs of 4, it allows for the state treasurer as the investment officer to use the state funds that you see in 293071. These are primarily a lot of the funds that are available to the state to be used for investment in those different bonds. Why is this a good idea? Mr. Chair, I think we will hear that.
I think we will.
Yes.
I think we're going to hear from the treasurer's office today.
And
sort of.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Kate Richardson. I'm the deputy state treasurer, and I'm just here to introduce Carol McCoo, who's the chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, and that's on whose behalf this bill's been introduced. That commission is staffed by the state treasurer's office. And also I'm going to introduce Laura Lockwood McCall, whom you've seen before, our debt management director at the state treasurer's office. So since these bills are, all the bills who are coming in today, the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission has put those in, one of those in conjunction with the state treasurer's office. You'll be hearing from Carol today primarily on the bills before you. So I'll pass it off to her.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Carol McCoo. I'm a partner with the law firm of K&L Gates and the chair of the MDAC. With respect to House Bill 2105, I thought I'd briefly describe to you the rationale for this bill. It allows state agencies and local governments to purchase their own bonds and allows them to keep the bonds outstanding while they hold the bonds.
Thank you.
The applicability of the bill arises primarily in the context of auction rate bonds and variable rate bonds, and those are bonds that pay interest where the interest is set and determined primarily based on a Dutch auction-style remarketing structure. The structure of those bonds depends on there being investors available and willing to buy bonds from current bondholders. When the financial markets became severely distressed, bond insurers who had issued insurance policies for auction rate bonds and banks who had issued letters of credit for variable rate demand bonds were downgraded, and investors lost confidence in those institutions. As such, the bondholders who were holding the auction rate bonds and variable rate bonds wanted to sell those bonds, but no one wanted to buy them. When an auction rate bond has a failed auction, what happens is, under the documents, the bondholders that have them have to hold on to them, but the interest rate paid on those bonds jumps to a maximum rate that is preset in the documents, sometimes as high as 8%, 12%, sometimes higher. for variable rate demand bonds, the letters of credit, the banks that issue the letters of credit, buy those bonds from these investors who want to sell them. And if they are unable to resell those bonds, then the bonds will start to amortize over a short period of time at a very high interest rate. So the issuers of the bonds became the unfortunate victims of the credit problems of the bond insurers and the letters of credit banks. So those issuers, faced with potentially paying very high interest rates on auction rate bonds and faced with very unfavorable amortizations for variable rate bonds, decided that it may be in their best interest to actually buy their own bonds, essentially become those investors who are willing to buy the bonds. And that's what the primary component of the first part of 2105 does, is it authorizes governments to purchase their own bonds. The second primary component of the bill allows those bonds to remain outstanding while the issuers are holding on to them. And that is there to deal with a legal theory called extinguishment that says that if you buy your own debt, that debt is essentially extinguished. But it is the case that for these issuers, it may be advantageous to keep the bonds outstanding. Those bond issuers who purchased the insurance and the letters of credit that's causing all this trouble, they paid for that up front. They paid the full premium at the time the bonds were issued. So it could be that at some point these institutions will be rehabilitated, their ratings will go back up, the auction rate markets and the variable rate markets will come back, and these issuers will want to resell those bonds back into the market and fully realize the benefit of the insurance and the letters of credit that they purchased at the outset. So, the second primary component of this bill allows them to keep it outstanding to hopefully at one point resell these bonds again. My understanding is that California adopted a bill like this a while ago while it was in session when the crisis was occurring. It provides flexibility for issuers who find themselves in this situation, and we obviously feel that this is important flexibility for issuers, and that is why there's an emergency clause in case an issuer needs to take advantage of this legislation. Laura?
For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management. I'm going to give you just a brief summary of some of the things that were happening for our state agencies who have variable rate debt during the height of the crisis in the fall. We don't have any auction rate securities of any sizable amount in the state, but we do have three major programs that issue variable rate debt for a portion of their overall debt portfolio. This helps blend down their interest costs. You should realize that prior to the credit crisis, our weekly resets on our variable rate debt was in the neighborhood of 2%. And long-term debt is in the neighborhood of 5%. So when I say you can blend down the rate, in the case of ODOT, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and Oregon Housing Community Services, they have a portfolio of debt that incorporates both variable and fixed rate debt. But in essence, this is an asset liability matching technique. The liquidity providers for ODOT and ODVA, a portion of their debt, the liquidity provider was Dexia, which is a large bank in Europe. And Dexia's credit came under severe crisis because it owns FSA, which is a bond insurance firm, as well as a variety of other things. And we saw, right after Lehman filed for bankruptcy, our rates shoot up on our weekly resets. It had nothing to do with our own credit. It had everything to do with Dexia's credit. We were in the 2% range, and we shot up to well over 8% on our weekly resets for many weeks. We also had bonds that we couldn't find an investor for, even at an 8% rate or 9%, and they simply put the bonds back to Dexia. And we were kind of concerned as France, Belgium, and Luxembourg was funding up Dexia. You know, we never thought in my life that I'd be worried about foreign banks in terms of issuing municipal bonds. What was going to happen? ODOT had, I think, in the neighborhood of $30 or $40 million in bank bonds. Now, they had a fairly positive, low interest cost once they were bank bonds. But as Carol mentioned, once 3 months passed, we'd start amortizing that debt fairly rapidly. At this point, all of the bonds that were Dexia bonds are back in the market, both for ODOT and Oregon Veterans. And I have some representatives here if you want to know more about it. And the interest rates have dropped. I think they're below 1.5% at this point, in some cases below 1%. So the short end of the yield curve, things have calmed down. However, It would have been nice, while we were going through the analysis of what to do, could we find an alternative liquidity provider? Should we fix out the debt? Just to know that one of our choices, if we have cash in the bank, was that we could temporarily purchase these bonds so that we didn't have to pay that high interest rate. We didn't have to necessarily amortize the whole amount. Because, again, these are bonds that are part of a longer program. Each of these three agencies have sufficient cash balances on a temporary basis to probably get through this situation. But I know of other issuers in the state, particularly in the healthcare area, who've sold auction rate bonds, who simply had failed auctions and haven't been able to get their interest rates lowered. So this may be of great benefit to them.
Interesting. Questions, comments? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I suppose the question is, we should ask you to guess at whether we're going to see this again.
Excellent question, Representative.
Feel free.
I'll answer that. In that, I'm not going to answer that by saying we don't know if we'll see it again, but it would be very good to have this tool if we did.
And through the chair, Representative Vance, I think that for the months of September and October, I've never seen this before in my public finance career, which has spanned about 25 years at this point, and most of the people who I work with would say the same thing. Having said that, now that we're in this liquidity crisis and it's of worldwide proportions, we're not out of the woods yet. Liquidity is the key to everything. So I don't know that we're in crisis mode, but I also think it's hard to walk away from really low short-term rates when it's necessary for your program. But in a year or two, most of the liquidity agreements we have for these three agencies will expire because they're relatively short. They're usually 3 to 5 years. And we're going to have to decide and see if there's any other liquidity providers. Can we do self liquidity, or will we have to convert everything to fixed rate? So I don't think we're going to be in the immediate crisis, but we're not out of the woods in terms of having to come up with some solutions. Because unless the federal government or someone with really deep pockets steps in to provide liquidity, we may not be able to buy it at rates that are financially attractive to us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're asking that we, under this bill, approve the use of funds that an agency may have available to basically supply its own short-term liquidity need. And that would mean that we are shifting reliance. We're using those funds, and it would seem then that we would have less of that money available because we bought our own debt back. Now, so my question is, how does this impact, how do we know then the impact this has upon the budgets and the long-term planning of these agencies?
Well, I'm going to answer briefly, but then I would perhaps invite two of the agencies have their CFOs here who have variable rate debt. I think in the case, I'll speak for ODOT, who isn't here. We had $265 million in variable rate debt, and the plan was if we temporarily had to buy these bonds, we were going to then convert everything to fixed rate, because this is part of the longer-term OTIA program. So there would be a temporary, let's use cash and not have to pay high interest rates if we had to, and then we would just bond it out. So it was the same bonding. So I think that was the answer for them. And so it was really just sort of using cash as a sort of a bridge loan, if you will. In the cases of ODVA, they have a really large cash balance, and they have a program that the CFO can describe to you. So I think, again, they had sufficient cash that it wouldn't really affect but in the short run in the budgetary. In the long run, I do think that the prospects of ODVA and how well it can manage itself would be affected by loss of access to short-term variable rate debt. And I'm going to let the Oregon housing people describe how they would manage through that as well. So I don't think we're out of the woods at all. And I think that's something we're going to have to continue to grapple with. This is just a short-term tool for what could be potentially a very long-term problem for those agencies.
One follow-up. Now this question is going to reflect how little I know about your systems. But in in our part of the world, we would normally ask third parties to comment and on what's happening so that we would know for sure. And I don't want this to be reflective negatively on any agency head. We would simply ask those third parties. Now, I assume that our bond rating is exactly that. Is that correct? Or does the bond rating folks, our credit rating as a state, does this come into play at any point so we have a third-party call on a technique we are now using?
The answer is we do, and you should realize that our ODOT has its own credit rating because it's a separate revenue bond, as would Oregon Housing and Community Services. And then the ODVA program is a general obligation credit, so it's basically the state's credit rating. But in each case when we sell bonds for each of these programs, somebody's kicking the tires and independently evaluating the creditworthiness of each of these programs. They all have high credit ratings, okay, at the moment. These are well-managed programs. I think the way you know it's a well-managed program, we're worrying about things that haven't happened yet. We're trying to plan ahead and think about contingency plans, and this bill represents one of those contingency plans.
And I would say that in the context of the auction rate and variable rate bonds, I think investors were getting somewhat lazy about looking through at the high credit rating of the issuers and relying on the credit rating of the insurers and the banks that were issuing the letters of credit, because they were all highly rated institutions at the time. So I think as a result, you know, when those institutions began to fail, people fled. So it really isn't a reflection of the underlying credit rating of the issuer. It is the result of the structure of these sorts of of these instruments. And I will just want to also add that this, of course, as Laura explained, every issuer is going to have to evaluate how they're going to deal with this situation depending on their own situation and circumstances and cash position. This bill also allows local governments to have the flexibility as well. I just wanted to make that point.
One final question.
Please. Yeah.
It wasn't so much the situation. It's whether or not we start using our own money to fund what maybe should have been long-term debt to begin with. And I understand that 2% money versus 5% money, a huge temptation, and who would have ever guessed? I mean, I understand all that. But now that we are in this soup, maybe the better question is how long to get out of it? How long do you think it's going to take before you can get out of the short-term field into the long-term?
Well, again, we try to do asset liability matching. So in the case of ODOT, we run cash balances in excess of $200 million. So in essence, we're matching variable rate debt, which is floating rate debt, with our floating rate assets. So our ideal is to do that and to find that perfect balance. The same thing would be true for Oregon Department of Veterans. So it would be a shame to have to leave the variable rate market necessarily. It's really not about just issuing variable rate because we can get 2%. I mean, it's good because it blends on our interest costs, but it also reduces our risk, actually, to have that in balance. So issuers like for these three in particular would be poorly served if we can't find a self-liquidity or some other solution if we can't find new bank letters of credit in a few years.
I have another question. I think I know the answer, but I want to be certain I understand it. This bill does not authorize the Treasury to use funds from one area in order to manage the debt in another area. This only allows you to use those matching funds that you were describing within an agency to deal with the short-term debt of that agency.
That's correct. And I'm not quite sure, and I guess I would turn to my legal experts as to whether there also would probably need to be an appropriation or some legislative action to accompany that. But I think we need to at least establish that we aren't extinguishing debt if we so choose to do this on a temporary basis.
Right. What I understand you want to do, and this sort of follows up on the answer that you just gave to Representative Vance, is you want to be able to unwind and then rewind based on what's going on out there in the external market without having to worry that you're going to have to go through the whole debt issuance process again. If I understand this correctly.
That's correct.
Okay. But the safeguard here is that we're not crossing funds we're not taking money out of one fund and using it to unwind the debt in another fund. Have I got that correct or not?
The bill, in this bill. The bill actually isn't restrictive or limiting in that sense. It authorizes it contains expenditure authority for a state agency or a treasurer to purchase bonds with funds or accounts that are held with the state treasurer or in some cases with a trustee that's acting as a bond trustee for the program. So there isn't this specificity. It's more of flexibility.
But I would suggest that the agencies involved most likely have continuous appropriations for their debt service. My guess would be that they would probably deploy debt service funds as the first purchase option. Again, there are three agencies in our state that have variable rate. They wouldn't be crossing funds, but this bill didn't really address that. This is more the larger framework of bond issuance in general, at least in its current form.
Okay. I'm not sure that I got the answer to my question. Maybe I didn't. I just didn't hear it correctly.
I don't think we've addressed your question.
Let me ask it a different way. One of the things that concerns me about this kind of an approach is the possibility that a credit crisis could go on and funds that are needed for a purpose have been committed to deal with a liquidity issue in another area and therefore are not available for their initial purpose. I'm wondering whether this bill addresses that issue or whether it's addressed in some other way, and whether we ought to think about that as we think about this additional authority.
I don't think we've addressed it yet. I don't know if
I would let the agency first.
Housing, perhaps. We haven't addressed it yet.
Okay.
I will concur.
But you see the problem I'm worried about.
I think some additional amendments might help.
What we've experienced in the last several months is something that the experts told us was never going to happen, which leads me to wonder, it leads me to believe that, in fact, anything I can imagine might actually happen. Well, I can imagine quite a lot. And one of the things I can imagine is a situation in which we have committed Treasury funds that are designed for liquidity, important liquidity purposes, to cover what looks like a short-term interest rate crisis of the kind you described, but turns out to be a much longer-term problem and becomes impossible to unwind in a reasonable time. If that were to happen, then I could imagine that we could be in a situation where we would end up issuing warrants for payroll instead of checks, or a variety of other kinds of things that we might end up doing. And I admit that this is far-fetched, but what happened in September, October, I would have considered far-fetched in August.
Well, I think that at least Mr. Shriver's here can talk about the Veterans Program and how it's structured, because I think it's within the four corners of each of the programs. So it wouldn't dig out, but I think...
And that's the key to the question I'm asking about the bill. If the bill keeps it within the four corners of the program so that the Veterans Program cannot be, the Veterans Bonds cannot be purchased by the Treasurer in a different program, then I think my question is answered.
Currently, the bill provides that the bonds can be purchased with funds or accounts that are held with the state treasury and appropriated or legally available for the payment of the costs of the related agency to administer the bond program or to pay the bonds. So there is a little bit of a limitation around the appropriated or illegally available funds in the bill.
Well, I tell you, I'd like to have that really explored and described in some care. If we're about to, I like the general idea of your being able to wind and unwind without extinguishing the bonds, which is what this bill is about. That seems, to me, that seems like a fine idea. But it also seems to me as though the safeguard around that needs to be that only the funds of the agency involved should be used in this way, because then the only agency affected by an extended credit problem is that agency, not the entire state government. That would be a very serious concern to me about this bill if, in fact, it allows for that possibility.
And like I said, currently the language of the bill provides that the appropriated or legally available funds used to pay purchase the bonds would need to be those funds that are otherwise available for the related agency to administer the bond program or to pay for those bonds. So it is possible that if the legislature appropriated bonds for to pay those to purchase those bonds, they would thus fall within the bill. It doesn't currently limit what is already there within the agency, but it is tied to the amounts that are appropriated to the agency to pay for the bonds.
But I would just add that we can check with both DOJ and Ledge Council to ascertain that we really captured your point of view.
Thank you. I don't know whether this concern is a realistic one or not, but I would have guessed in the summer that what actually happened in September, October was not realistic, but it actually did happen. So
sure.
I want to be, if we're going to go to a new mechanism like this, I want to be very cautious about how we run it out. And then we've got someone who wants to talk about a specific program. Is that right?
Well, he can answer questions in how his program is functioning, which is the closest to the general fund, if you're curious, because it's the general obligation of the state.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Schreiber. I'm the CFO of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I think the gist of some of the questions coming out here and maybe how the department would use this would be really looking at it on using this bill, the authority from this bill, to make temporary investments. Like you mentioned, in September, October, we had funds that were invested below the cost of what our variable rate debt was being repriced at. So if we had this tool, we actually, on a temporary basis, could have just basically purchased our own bonds. That would have helped drive down our variable rate debt and, you know, eliminated during that period of time some variable rate or some negative arbitrage. I mean, that's what's attractive,
sure,
to have that tool available in the toolkit.
Right, and I agree that this is a great idea. Let's suppose the situation arose in which you couldn't wind it back out again. I'm not sure quite what the right word is, but
couldn't find new buyers.
That you couldn't find new buyers for the bonds later at an interest rate that you were willing to pay, or maybe at all. At that point, the effect on your agency would be a loss of liquidity. There'd be some things you might not be able to do because you didn't have cash. But it wouldn't affect the other aspects of the state government or the Treasury if it operates exactly the way you've described. I think
it shouldn't affect the other
right
entities.
Okay. All right. What would be the effect on your agency if you were in that situation and you decided to purchase your own bonds under this bill? And then it turned out that it was a year or 2 years or 3 years before you could resell them or sell something else to cover the same debt.
Well, this debt does have put options. I mean, you have the ability to put it back to the bank.
Let me ask it a different way, because I don't think I really asked the question to ask. What effect would it have on your operations if your cash were tied up in this bond situation, and therefore the cash wasn't available for other uses?
Most of the money that we would be investing would be temporary investments. So our options would be to put it back, or if we had to, we could call out the bonds.
Thank you.
I think the longer-term prognosis, though, would be the earnings that they're able to achieve in today's market, where we have a positive spread between what we can earn versus what it costs us for the debt, that would go away. So to the extent that their operations would shrink, and I think that's what the chair is headed, it may force you to cut back, because it's a positive spread in most credit conditions for Department of Veterans Affairs.
I was really trying to ask a different question,
but
that is, what would you otherwise do with this cash if it were available? Would you write more mortgages? Would you spend it in some other way? Or is it something that you keep as a permanent arbitrage?
Mr. Chairman, probably a combination of all those. Some of these monies we would temporarily invest for recycling into loans.
Mm-hmm.
Other of it is just to match up our asset liability structure.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? I really would like a definitive answer to the essential question that I've asked. I would be very concerned if this bill authorized you to buy the sort of debt of one agency with funds from a different agency, or with funds from the Treasury held for the general fund or some other way. And if it doesn't do that, then I'm probably okay with the bill. I don't know. Of course, I don't speak for any other member of the committee. If it does do that, then I'm probably not okay with the bill as it stands. Just simply because I'd be very worried about allowing a tool which at some point in time, when no one believes it's possible, would cause us a problem.
Well, we will get clarification.
Thank you.
On that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
It actually allows the state treasurer to use all state funds.
That's what I thought it did, and that's the reason I asked the question.
Funds and
yeah, that's the reason I asked the question.
Now,
it may be that my fears are groundless, and you can talk me out of that, but I need to be talked out of it if I'm going to support this bill, if it's written the way Mazin says it is.
Okay.
Thank you. Anything else?
Thank Mr. Chairman, members
yes.
of the committee, I also should
Please.
Mention there are some amendments. There's one amendment currently being drafted. It's a technical one. It
mm-hmm.
moves up a definition that is now used in this bill up to the front of the statute.
Just changes the location.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have one.
Certainly.
I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
And I'm not the attorney on this, but I did want to make the point that one reason that as Mazin just made that point, the treasurer could buy these bonds as an investment also. So if it meant the investment criteria for the PERS fund, for instance, it would be doing that as an investment, not to just help out an agency. It would be an investment.
Thank you. And, of course, that's a whole different world, isn't it?
It is.
And
it
at
is.
That point, if the bill is explicit about that, it might make a difference.
All right.
Thank you. Representative Pence.
No, I just need to have her state her name so I know who she is.
I'm sorry. Again, Kate Richardson, Deputy State Treasurer. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony on this bill. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on which one are we on?
2105.
I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2105 and open up public hearing on House Bill 2106. Is that yours?
That's Steve's, Mr. Chair. I'll be back for 2107.
Okay. Sorry. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2106 deals with school district bonding. Currently, when a school district prepares to go to the voters for approval of a large construction project, which involves bonding of more than $1 million, it has to do a site safety improvement for the proposed construction site. What the bill allows is for the school district to change the site, construction site, after the voters have approved the bond, so they could go from one site to another site as long as the new site meets an evaluation for safety improvements. So it gives some leeway to the district as to where the site is located after the bonds have been approved by the voters.
Okay, and under the current rule, then would they have to go out for another election?
Mr. Chair, that's...
If they wanted to change the site?
That's the question.
That is
not
an answer.
Sure about that.
This statute would answer that.
Yes.
Okay, great. Carol?
Thank you. And for the record, again, Carol McCoug, partner with K&L Gates and chair of the MDAC. staff, legislative revenue staff described, currently the statute requires a school district to conduct the safety evaluation prior to the bond election on sites for potential school facility projects. It is possible, and actually quite likely, that between the time of the safety evaluation and the time that the bonds are actually issued, which could be a course of a few years, a school district may find alternate sites that are more appropriate for the school facilities that they intend to build with the bond proceeds. In some cases, other properties may become available for sale that are more appropriate. The scope of the projects could change. Perhaps more extensive analysis of sites on environmental issues could prove that the original sites to be inappropriate. In some cases, people will donate land to the school district. And so the statute currently is unclear as to whether a school district could take advantage of more appropriate sites because they have not conducted a safety evaluation prior to the bond election. So certainly we're not trying to eliminate the need to do a safety evaluation. The bill requires the school district to perform the safety evaluation on the alternate site. But this makes it clear that alternate sites can be evaluated and potentially used with the bond proceeds for school facilities. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Stringer.
Thank you. Is there a particular instance that incident that gave rise to this conversation?
Yes, specifically with Salem Kaiser School District, because this is a new statute. They had just issued a very large had a very large bond measure approved, and which is very common these days to have a very large bond measure approved for multiple projects, multiple schools and facilities. And it's very hard prior to the election for them to have evaluated all potential sites for the numerous projects they intend to build with the bond proceeds. And so they felt that the statute was unclear as to whether they could subsequently find alternate sites.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can, having been through a school board situation and having been through a siting situation with incredibly negative consequences of the bond election, I would have an extraordinary difficult time supporting this proposal, primarily because in a small town, the location is everything. And if the bond passed and then the district moved it, the school board members could never return to the small town. And so it's the type of thing that, if it was in the statute, would make folks voting for the bond even less likely to support it, because they wouldn't know for sure where the school is going to go. Now, this is a small town issue. It may not apply to larger places like Salem, but I could not support it in its current fashion, or I couldn't go home.
The tar would be kept hot.
Yes, it would.
Representative Call.
Thank you. I guess my question is, and this probably shows my ignorance of the bond measure process, I'm wondering what level of specificity has to be there with regards to the bond measure that's being brought to the voters, such that you could take a more generalized bond out to the voters, not defining the sites that you would like to have your schools cited at, and therefore not, and make the need for this statute irrelevant. Is that possible under current law? Does that make sense?
It is. However, I think the reality is, and certainly I can appreciate Representative Ben's situation, because of the limitation on the number of words available in a summary for a ballot title, the need to provide for numerous facilities that are going to be financed with the bond measure. It is extremely uncommon for some of the larger districts, particularly, to have listed within the ballot title the specific locations of every school project, every school facility that will potentially be financed with the bond measure. Now, certainly, if they have in the course of the bond campaign and the other materials described a particular site and move it, I can appreciate they will experience some probably political repercussions associated with doing so. But I think currently, legally, the statute is restrictive and does not provide the flexibility of really the reality of the situation for many school districts, which is that they only go to the voters a few times over the course of a number of years. They have a lot of projects that they anticipate needing over the course of those few years with populations growing, and they need to be able to have some flexibility to plan for, again, alternate sites that would come up for purchase that were not available for purchase perhaps prior to the election. So this is, again, another tool in the toolkit, and we think that as the statute currently reads, it might trap some school districts in this situation.
Yes, please.
Let me ask my question a little differently then. I'm in Reynolds School District. We need a new high school. It seems to me that Reynolds School Board could bring the bond measure out in two different ways. They could have a siting process before the bond measure is issued, come up with a site, have community involvement, issue the bond with regards to that specific site. Or they could say, we need a new high school, and go to seek a bond without ever talking about where it's going to be sited at all. And there are two processes there. One of them needs the statute, seemingly, and the other one doesn't. And what I'm wondering is why we need a statute if the school boards have the flexibility to bond in two different ways, one of them gets around this problem. Does that make sense?
I think we're dealing with two issues in terms of what the school board will legally do in terms of authorization.
Okay.
They could obtain authorization for a particular site, and if they include that in the ballot title, they have to do that. But if they don't, as you mentioned, the statute still requires them to do the safety evaluation on a site prior to the election. So in a way, it inadvertently binds them.
Thank you. That clarifies, that gets at the question.
Yes, just in addition to that, Steve has pointed out that lines 8 through 13 really does do exactly what the witness is saying, that it binds the district to pick a site and do the safety evaluation, although it doesn't specifically say you have to pick a site. It does say you got to do all these safety evaluations or safety improvement, deal with safety improvement issues before the election. So it has that effect. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure I understand what we're talking about here. It seems to me that the issue that Representative Benz points out has nothing to do with this bill. This bill simply says if the school board or whoever the siting authority is finds a better site, they may do it after the bond sale with it, and then perform the evaluations. It doesn't say they have to.
Yeah, Representative Benz.
Right. In response, I would just... The point here is whether or not the opportunity for the board to change the location after the vote is given by this bill. And it looks to me as it says, allows a school district with voter approval of a bond greater than $1 million to change the construction site after voter approval.
Yes,
am I reading that incorrectly?
Right. So the statute currently, as we were discussing, the statute currently requires them to do safety evaluations on sites. It could be a number of potential sites for a school facility or numerous school facilities that are being contemplated to be financed under the bond measure. So they are not legally bound to use those original sites, as we described, unless it's in the ballot title. They're not legally, the authorization is not tied to the particular site. it's that the bond, the statute, that this current statute requires them to do safety evaluations for potential sites for school facilities prior to the election. So unless the authorization is bound under the ballot title to a site, the school board could legally change sites. They have alternate sites. This statute places a limitation on that flexibility.
Did you have something to add to that?
And Mr. Chair, again, Kate Richardson, Deputy State Treasurer. And going to this, and this is to try to keep in spirit of the safety evaluation legislation that was put forward in the last session. It's because there was that pre-existing authority for a school board to change the site before the safety evaluation legislation was put in place. If their bond issuance allowed, or their bond election allowed that. What has happened then is that with this imposition of the safety evaluation, which is no one's arguing that's a very good thing, but because of the timing of that safety evaluation, it limits the school district, perhaps even once they've become aware of a new site, that may be the safest site. But because of the timing of the safety evaluation, that this legislation had required it before the election, the school district would be precluded from using that if they did the full safety evaluation.
Yes, Representative Gantz, please.
So, in following Representative Riley's comment, is it then that this is not a change in the law allowing the school board to change the site? That already is allowed, and this is merely a means of not stumbling over the safety evaluation. Is that what's going on?
Yes.
Okay, then. If the school district already has the power to change the site after the vote, and this is merely to square up the safety evaluation so it doesn't inhibit that, then I'll be much more likely to support it. And I thank Representative Riley for pointing that out.
And if I may, Mr. Chair?
Please.
It doesn't allow the school board to change the site if the site is in the ballot title. Mm-hmm. It's only if there's no site mentioned in the ballot title. Am I correct about that?
That's right.
Thank you.
Right. So in Representative Bent's small city, which we have several, if the ballot title mentioned the site of the school as the place where the school was going to be built, the school board would then be prohibited from moving it without another election.
That's right, Dee.
All right. So the school board can protect itself from the tar and feathers we were discussing by putting it in the ballot title.
And it will.
Okay. Representative Spring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former school board member who came on at the tail end of a bond project and the sensitivity of that, a lot of these issues can be addressed by simply saying that when you're promoting your bond measure and you're attempting to get it passed, you have to be as open and transparent as possible if you have any hope whatsoever of passing it. And so I think there's almost a greater standard there, quite frankly, that the voters are holding school boards to. However, as I think through this process and help me complete this line of thinking, I'm thinking about the district, and this is not the exception. This is closer to the rule, quite frankly. You have the school board, the school district that goes out for a bond and it fails once, twice, three times. And they've done all this work in year one and the safety evaluations, and they go back a couple years later or 4 years later. The thinking process I'm going down right now is they've done these safety evaluations and they failed and they go out again. The criteria could change, the safety factors could change from that original evaluation based on growth in a particular area. Have we boxed the school board in? Am I making my question clear? Because again, I've been sitting here for the last 5 minutes trying to continue this line of thinking, and I haven't done that yet, so help me out a little bit. Maybe I wasn't completely clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I do think I understand your question. That's not the issue that the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission is bringing to board. That kind of goes to the original bill in the last session, whether it boxes that or not. As it reads here, it's prior to receiving approval from the electors. And, well, you advise I'll let the attorney to local governments here address whether prior to is way back years before or recent.
Well, and if I may, and if I have brought an issue in that isn't completely germane to this language, then that's fine, and just clarify that for me.
I do think that the question that you're asking is more germane to the current statute, which came into place with the bill from the last session, and is not what our amendment is trying to address.
Okay. Great. That answers it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Others? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2106? I don't see anyone, and for that reason, we will close the hearing on House Bill 2106. Now, we're on time so far, colleagues. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2107. And you're back, Mazza.
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me back. Mathematic Legislative Revenue Office, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2107 is another one that comes from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, MDAC, and the bill, although attempts to do about three different things, and it looks in different ways complicated. The meat of the bill comes in the first page when on line 14 when it takes out the limitation that says at the end of the line not to exceed 0.5% of the real market value. This allowance before for the local government or counties mostly to go to bond without voter approval. This is taking out of the language of the law. Then you would have the second biggest impact of this bill would be also on the second page on section 4. This is where the issue of using the revenue bonds, the conduit revenue bonds, and giving the state treasurer the ability to lend money and so on for the exchange rates or interest rate swaps. And also you would have that spelled out on page 3, line 39. And then finally, the one of the most important things that this bill does is on page 4, on line 32, that's 7 subs of A, where it inserts that where the may be paid from monies derived from issuance and sale of revenue bonds allows, gives a legal authority for these exchange interest rates issuance to be coming out of revenues that have originated from the sale of revenue bonds. The other types of changes that you find in page 5 all the way from line 8 down to line 23 are basically removing some language of what the general obligation bonds are. And the final thing that you want to bring your attention to is the page 6. This is a stylistic change of where is the 13% of the real market value of all property that is the limit for the amounts of indebtedness for counties. And That's what the bill does, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, members of the committee, I'm Carol McCoot, I'm chair of the MBAC. This bill contains a number of technical fixes to the public finance statutes. In 2007, the legislature passed a bill that was put forth by the Oregon Law Commission. It was a project that where a number of members of the public finance community participated in, including members of the MDAC and staff from the Office of the State Treasurer. The Law Commission bill, the project was designed to overhaul and streamline a few of the general public finance statutes, and the bill has become what is now ORS 286A and 287A. House Bill 2107 contains a number of technical fixes to clarify some of the statutes, to fix some of the cross-references to those statutes, clarify and conform some of the other public finance statutes as they now relate to the new general public finance chapters. And, you know, we've discovered a few things that need to be fixed now that we've lived under the new statutes for a little while now. So I'm happy to answer questions on particular sections, but in general it's a packed full of technical fixes.
Laura, did you want to...
My only brief comment, and it's a little bit patting ourselves on the back.
Identify yourself again for the record, if you
like. Laura Lockwood McCall. When we... went through the legislative process. Chair Barnhart was with us. Our Oregon Law State Law Commission bill was well over 250 pages, and everybody said, trust us. But we weren't sure, because, you know, you do the best you can to clean up language. We had an opt-out provision in an administrative rule that if anybody found a major flaw in the law, that they could come to the state treasurer's office and use the old laws. And I'm happy to report in the last 2 years no one has come to us and asked to be opted out. So I'm pleased that this is a small, tiny little bill for MDAC, and we think that we found any little remaining things that we need to fix. So that's why I'm, you know, a little proud of ourselves, and I think we did a fairly good job.
Do you think that this is it in terms of fixing that bill? I mean, I have to say, let me add parenthetically that if you manage to get it into 7 pages, and most of which is simply a repetition of the statutes as they exist, that's pretty good, considering what a massive overhaul that bill last time was.
I would suggest, I feel fairly confident, short of curveballs coming from various places I couldn't have dreamed of a year ago.
And then I've got another question. Section 4, which goes into mind-numbing variations about conduit borrowers and such, is that really a restatement of what the current law is?
That was a request by one of the bond counsels who's not here today to just state it for the record so that when they give legal opinions that indeed it was the intent of the legislature to allow conduit borrowers to utilize these proceeds to terminate swap payments. They felt that it was important for their legal opinions.
And they believe that's what the law is now.
The state currently has the authority to do it. It's clarified in this bill for the local governments. You can read, but it clarifies it for the local governments. Folks were concerned that because of the structure of conduit bonds, where the issuer is actually the conduit issuer and the swap is actually entered into by the conduit borrower, that perhaps the statutes could be clarified to make it clear that the swap payments would be used, the bond proceeds could be used to pay the swap termination payments in a conduit borrowing structure.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, I remind you that you were the one who carried that bill.
I do recall that. I do recall that. I also recall reading it about 3 times as we went through amendments. It wasn't easy reading, and sometimes I did it late at night when the inclination was strong to do something else. Thank you very much.
With a glass of wine.
We appreciate the testimony. No, actually, there wasn't any wine involved at all. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2107? I don't see anyone, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2107. Colleagues, it appears we've exhausted our agenda half an hour early, so you get an extra 40 minutes between now and the time that the House convenes. And with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow.